You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the 25th Annual Hollywood Issue for 2019. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Now for this month's editor's letter from Radhika Jones, with photographs by Landon Nordman. In the photos, Radhika Jones on the set of the Hollywood Issue cover shoot. Jones, Vanity Fair deputy editor Kira Pollack, camera assistant Hector Hernandez, production designer Beau Welch, and set director Laurie Gaffin at work. Once upon this time in Hollywood, what better way to celebrate the 25th Annual Vanity Fair Hollywood Issue than to make a real-life motion picture as its cover? We did it in Los Angeles, of course, enlisting a very special guest as director, the three-time Academy Award-winning cinematographer Emmanuel Chivo Lubetsky. Over two electrifying days at the Los Angeles Theater, he shot some of the most brilliant lights of current cinema, doing what they do best, acting, chatting, dancing, gazing from under smoky lids, and otherwise engaging with a camera that captured them in non-stop eloquent motion. It was exhilarating to watch the star power behind the lens connect with the star power in front of it. Together, our 11 cover subjects have acted in more than 150 films. This year marked the first for Yalitza Aparicio, the beating heart of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, and the 24th for Saoirse Ronan, who stole the show as Brioni Talis in Atonement back in 2007. Ronan was a baby when the first Vanity Fair Hollywood cover came out, capping off the 1994-95 awards season. Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery won the award for Best Original Screenplay for Pulp Fiction that year, while Forrest Gump took Best Picture, Best Director, Robert Zemeckis, and Best Actor, Tom Hanks, as well as the awards for Adapted Screenplay, Editing, and Visual Effects. I had seen both movies in a theater near my apartment in Taipei, where I was spending the year after college graduation teaching English. They still feel perfectly representative of the dual strands of Hollywood's appeal: raw, risky, auteur-driven versus wholesome, earnest, bankable, star-driven. Life is like a box of chocolates. You might get to watch John Travolta and Uma Thurman do the twist. You might get Samuel L. Jackson hurling a version of Ezekiel 25:17 at you before you die in a hail of bullets. My theory of recent history is that it often lurks in a cultural blind spot. Canonization takes longer than two decades. We know what to read from 100 years ago, but 25 years ago was a much harder call. The same goes for television, movies, and the news events that simmer in the culture, waiting for the clarity of hindsight. The slippage of recent history also tracks with one's own life. I saw far more movies in the 1990s than I did in the decade that followed, because in the 90s, I had time to do things like escape to the Paris Theater in the afternoon to watch Mike Leigh's delectable Topsy-Turvy. It's a time-lapse thing. You get busy pursuing grown-up existence, and then suddenly you look around and realize that they're making movies about the story of Tanya Harding, which surely happened not so long ago, and drama series about the O.J. Simpson trial, which you watched in real time in Taipei as if it were America's chief export. And maybe it was. Those stories, Those characters are as new to a younger generation as the Cuban Missile Crisis and Watergate were to me. Which is to say, they're ripe for the moving picture treatment. So, as we dreamed up this 25th annual issue, we looked into the rich, half-tangible, half-elusive recent past to help inform the present. Our chief critic, Richard Lawson, and film critic K. Austin Collins have assembled their list of the 25 most influential scenes of the last 25 years. Our executive West Coast editor, Krista Smith, talked to every participant of the first legendary Vanity Fair Hollywood cover. An all-women ensemble outfitted in head-to-toe attitude, shot by Annie Leibovitz. For this issue, Annie photographed Cicely Tyson, recipient of an honorary Oscar, with a tribute written by Viola Davis. Tarantino is here via an exclusive first look at his upcoming film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Next photos, Saoirse Ronan. And Chadwick Boseman with Ricky Rouse of the 11 o'clock news band. This was a record year for U.S. box office, led in part by Black Panther, which took in more than $700 million of a total $11.9 billion North American gross. It was a landmark year for diversity in casting, as Crazy Rich Asians became the first major Hollywood production with an all-Asian cast since The Joy Luck Club in 1993. It was a solid year for black male directors, who helmed 16 of the top 100 films, according to a study by USC Annenberg. It was not a great year for female directors, the study reports. One year after the founding of Time's Up, equity and equal opportunity in Hollywood still have a long way to go. But our cover stands as a celebration of the brilliance of this moment, the power, glamour, and potential inherent in the movies right now. Chadwick Boseman said it best when he told us, "The actors who are within the pages of this issue give new breath to what Hollywood is and what Hollywood is going to be." Our cover stars come from all over the world, from Henry Golding to Elizabeth Debicki to Regina King. They are charting their own paths to cinematic glory. Now more than ever, we in the theaters can see ourselves in the people up there on the screen. Who hasn't fantasized about thanking the Academy one day? And what is thanking the Academy, if not shorthand, for fulfilling your dream? My hope for this cover, for all our covers, is that in capturing a moment, it sets a fleet of new dreams in motion. Thank you. Now, for some of the contributors to this month's issue, Krista Smith profiles Emmanuel Chivo Lubezki, Moving Pictures. In the photos, Lubezki films Tessa Thompson at the Los Angeles Theater. Lubezki, Leonardo DiCaprio, and director Alejandro G. Iñárritu pose with their Oscars for The Revenant at the 2016 Academy Awards. Our cover maestro, Lubezki, made Hollywood history when he won a trifecta of Oscars for Gravity, 2013, Birdman, 2014, and The Revenant, 2015. I'm very happy and extremely lucky to have won, says the Mexican cinematographer. But minutes after you win, you realize you have not changed at all. It's best to keep going and keep studying and keep working. Chivo, the nickname means goat, and he's had it since boyhood, picked up his first camera, a Kodak Retina, around age 4. His memory of that early experience still informs his artistry. To see the light hitting the lens, it looked like a little jewel, he remembers. I wanted to eat it, touch it, smell it, and it was so beautiful to me. It's with the same sense of humility and curiosity that he approached capturing Vanity Fair's 25th annual Hollywood issue cover. Even though this will be his 50th year with a camera in hand, the master says he had freshman nerves walking onto the shoot. You guys have been doing it so well and so right for so many years. I was very frightened, but you just have to jump, says Lubezki. I wanted to feel the environment, but not make it too prominent. Everything had to happen really, really fast, and our appetite was big. These actors are absolutely fantastic at what they do, and because they don't hear the shutter click, the shoot is very fluid, says Lubezki. It's like a dance between them and the camera. And for some of the other contributors to this month's issue, Krista Smith, Hit Parade. The magazine's executive West Coast editor interviewed all 10 of the cover stars from Vanity Fair's original Hollywood issue in 1995. It was great to reminisce with them while simultaneously putting together the talent for the 25th cover, says Smith. It made me realize just how much this issue has become an institution in Hollywood. Viola Davis, the Wonder Woman. I understand entertainment, says the Academy Award-winning actress, but it was through Ms. Tyson, who plays Davis's mother in the ABC series How to Get Away with Murder, that I understood the true gift of artistry. Davis stars in the film Troop Zero, out this month. Peter Hapak, Screen Time. Taking pictures of my favorite directors was like having a cup of coffee with my best friends, says the Hungarian photographer who shot 5 of Hollywood's most influential auteurs for this issue, including Alfonso Cuarón. Photo sessions like these always inspire me to discover more. K. Austin Collins and Richard Lawson, 25 scenes, 25 years. It's not easy to compile a list of the 25 most influential scenes in recent film history. The true challenge, says Vanity Fair film critic Collins, was differentiating between iconic and influential. Adds Lawson, the magazine's chief critic, many memorable scenes are not on this list because we felt they were more singular than standard setting.
Thank you.
Behind the Issue by Britt Hinemuth, with photographs by Landon Nordeman, on the set for Vanity Fair's 25th Hollywood cover. Opening photos, Timothée Chalamet, Saoirse Ronan, and Chadwick Boseman get touch-ups on set. The sounds of a live six-piece jazz band wafted through the ballrooms, balconies, and hidden corridors of the historic Los Angeles Theater late last November as 11 of Hollywood's game-changers, newcomers, role models, and rule-breakers arrived for the 25th annual Vanity Fair Hollywood cover shoot. "This is surreal," marveled actor Timothée Chalamet as he descended the grand staircase into a dressing room. "It feels like a movie set." He wasn't wrong. At the helm of the full-scale production was three-day Academy Award-winning cinematographer, Gravity, Birdman, The Revenant, Emmanuel Chibo-Lubetsky, who, together with Oscar-nominated production designer Beau Welch, threw a two-day fete to rival the likes of Federico Fellini. "We're trying to capture that feeling of it's 4 a.m. after the party. You've gotten to know each other all night, and now you're in a moment of celebration," said cover star Tessa Thompson, Creed II, Sorry to Bother You, and three other films this year. "Like you've caught a secret." Creating that sort of pre-dawn ambiance required over 300 balloons, 200 champagne flutes, 28 trunks, 3 boxes, and 6 garment bags of designer threads to outfit the starry partiers. Oh, and a jazz band. Lubetsky captured ebullience in motion, turning his film into still portraiture. "It didn't feel like a cover shoot. It felt more like a fluid scene," said John David Washington, Black Klansman, The Old Man and the Gun. "As far as an actor's concerned, this is the future, a new frontier." "I've never quite experienced anything like it before," said Saoirse Ronan, Mary Queen of Scots, the Seagull. "This day will stay with me for quite a long time," said Rami Malek, Bohemian Rhapsody. "I was doing a scene with one of the greatest cinematographers in the history of cinema." The 2 days gave rise to their own party scene. Malek spoke in Spanish with Yalitzio Aparicio Roma and Lubetsky, who also happens to be a frequent collaborator with Aparicio's director, Alfonso Cuarón. Henry Golding, Crazy Rich Asians, arrived in Los Angeles just in time after filming Guy Ritchie's Tough Guys the evening before in London. Shooting in an 88-year-old cinema landmark only enhanced the magic. "It feels like I'm in the same place that Rita Hayworth may have been in the bathroom," laughed Regina King, "if Beale Street could talk." "If these walls could talk," said Washington, "Chaplin, Einstein, to be a part of that history is awesome." Perhaps the ghosts were jealous of all the fun, because in the midst of the photo shoot, the fire alarm and sprinklers went off. And scene. Next photos, Emmanuel Chibo-Lubetsky films Boseman, Tessa Thompson with members of the Los Angeles Fire Department, John David Washington, and Henry Golding. For this month's opening act column, Vanity Fair's Krista Smith speaks with Amandla Stenberg. Photographs by Lauren Dukoff, styled by Deborah Afshani. I want people to feel less alone, and I want to make something that will ground us in our humanity, says Amandla Stenberg, 20, the Hate U Give actress. In the opening photo, the actress is shown in a ruffled yellow dress and black sneakers. This past year was a major one for you. You most recently starred in The Hate U Give as a high school student who takes a stand after witnessing the police shooting of a friend. You're an activist in real life, too, and have become a voice of a generation looking for change. I accidentally became an activist, and that's still not necessarily a word that I self-label. I protest for sure, but I'm not out there on the front lines. It feels kind of presumptuous to take on that label, but I'm really honored that people conceptualize me that way. Given your impact, is there anything you haven't done yet that you want to do? I want people to feel less alone. I want them to feel represented. I want to make something that will ground us in our humanity. I have gone through periods of feeling alienated and isolated and wished there was representation for people who walk similar experiences to mine, whether that's queer people or people of color. I can speak up about the things that I understand, and I have been gifted this platform through acting. Which came first, the acting or the activism? I grew up in this industry, being so frustrated by the expectation to fulfill some sort of stereotype or trope, or to portray blackness or the black female experience in a way that I thought was kind of detrimental to us. So, I was really selective growing up, but the things I wanted, I chased after. And your breakout role was as Rue in the first installment of the Hunger Games films in 2012. I was a huge fan of the books, and Rue was written as having satin brown skin, which to an 11 or 12-year-old black girl who loves fantasy and fiction was exhilarating. When I heard they were making a movie, it became my ultimate goal to be in it. I knew they were putting out a wide net, and it would be challenging, but the casting director gave me a tip to really dress in character for the callback. So I rolled around in my backyard and was fully covered in mud with twigs in my hair, and I showed up ready. You also play the violin, co-wrote a comic book series, and recorded a Super Soul session for Oprah, right? You were blessed by O. Yes, the biggest blessing you can receive. I'm just guided by what I want to do. I love acting, but it's not the only thing I'm going to do with my life. It's important to me to chill out and shut up and learn. What do you do to chill out? Is music a form of meditation for you? Yeah, I love playing music. It's so pure. I started playing classical violin in these intense competitions where kids would cry in the corner before their recital. Then I met this amazing teacher who taught me how to improvise. Now it's a way to relax and a therapeutic tool. Recently, I've been making a lot of music with the intention of putting it out at some point, but not trying to put that pressure on myself. There's already enough pressure. So what can't you do well? Get on a sleep schedule that makes sense. Wash all my dishes when I'm supposed to. Fan Club. Common said, Amandla has a sensibility and sensitivity that sets her apart. Lena Dunham said, she exudes the confidence that makes you either a rock star or a successful candidate for president. And Issa Rae said, I really admire Amandla's range of talent. I can't wait to see her debut as a director. Watch List Alternate Oscars Edition, Outliers That Deserve Attention, by Richard Lawson. Widows, Who's In It, perhaps the finest ensemble of 2018, including Viola Davis, Cynthia Erivo, Colin Farrell, and a smashing Elizabeth Debicki. We'll remind you of Michael Mann's Heat and other sophisticated crime capers. Why now? Criminally overlooked at the multiplexes last year, Steve McQueen's elegant and incisive thriller is sharp, exciting, and rare. The front runner, Who's In It? Hugh Jackman, J.K. Simmons, Vera Farmiga, Sarah Paxton, and a lot of bad hair. We'll remind you of Robert Altman meets Aaron Sorkin. Why now? Though maybe not as relevant as it had hoped, Jason Reitman's smart, spirited, and really well-acted reenactment of Gary Hart's presidential campaign flameout is fascinating and crisply executed. Suspiria, Who's In It? Dakota Johnson, Tilda Swinton, and a whole bunch of other witches. We'll remind you of Dario Argento's original horror film from 1977, with some Black Swan thrown in. Why now? A great film that didn't quite get its due, this remake by Call Me By Your Name director Luca Guadagnino is scary and surprisingly soulful. And the dancing.
Thank you.
On to what's trending. The shoe fits. Three cheers for Clash Happy Maximalism by Lauren Mickling. Opening photo by Kiernan Monahan and Theo Vamvunakis. A sneaker sandal encrusted with fake jewels. Gucci rubber-soled sandals in leather, mesh, and crystals. And these shoes cost $1,250. As a sum of its parts, Gucci's new hiking sandal should be an eyesore. Its toe caps are pickle green, and the logoed Velcro straps call to mind the clip-ins at SoulCycle. Tricked out with detachable crystal webbing and zigzags of utility climbing rope, these sporty sandals convey a stew of associations. Dowager aunt, or painfully earnest outdoorsy dude from your freshman dorm. They are a challenge to the senses, a reworking of fundamental notions of grace and luxury, and yet they might just be everything we need right now. For those of us who have followed fashion's recent trajectory from normcore, think mom jeans and keds, to neo-modesty, it is hard to consider Gucci's shockingly maximalist shoes without coming to see our meek mistakes reflected in the dazzling hardware. Once your eyes adjust to the bling and the first ripple of glitz-induced delight washes over you, you might wonder if our current cult of norm chic has actually just been boring. Next photos. Happy feet, fanciful footwear from flat sandals to sky-high pumps. Shoes by Aquazura, Flashdance Crystal Pump, priced at $1,595. Attico Lilac Decolleté Pump with Crystals, priced at $1,776. Tabitha Simmons Crystal Embellished Mule at $725. Gianvito Rossi Athena Sandal, priced at $1,395. Valentino Garavani Sandal for $775. Miu Miu Heel at $1,200, and Manolo Blahnik, Meidiger in Blue Satin, priced at $995. For the past year and change, I have zealously clomped around in a self-imposed uniform of high-waisted cotton pants and tuber-shaped footwear. I celebrated my departure from corporate life by starting an Instagram account devoted to the wonderful world of clogs. Out went my flashy heels and silk dresses. In their place, an ascetic aesthetic inspired by all the creative-looking women I'd seen float by in their secretly expensive ho-hum garb. But go so many months without trying, or trying to look like you're not trying, and a certain dreariness sets in. When you find yourself swimming in a sea of self-same-clad individuals, you will understand that bucking convention can be the most conventional thing of all. Recently, I attended a friend's ladies' tea that was actually a cheek-to-jowl congress of highly intimidating and compatibly dressed Manhattan tastemakers. My plus one was my four-year-old daughter, Louisa. Clad in a heart print, swimming rash guard, a sparkly red tutu and hot pink leggings, Louisa bounded over to the couch where an iconoclastic magazine editor sat alone, an unapproachable baroness in magenta glasses and silvery topknot. The two sartorial deviants chatted about the superiority of pink, while the rest of us small-talked in our dreary tunics and wood-soled shoes. Soon, another woman joined the pair, wearing the sexy, tired look of a French actress and luxurious slippers in a buttery black leather. They were my own footwear's fancier cousin, too fabulous and logo-adjacent to be real clogs. As soon as Louisa and I returned home, I Googled around until I found the exact model. Gucci again, with a price three times what I have ever paid for clogs. Reader, I ordered them. If given the opportunity to shine, Who are we to deprive ourselves of the joy we got as children, adorning our T-shirts with an infomercial bedazzler? One of my happiest wedding night memories involves goofing around on the dance floor and looking down to see my post-ceremony Kate Spade heels peeking out from under my dress, their glitter-encrusted bows shining up at me like two disco balls. There is an undeniable exhilaration in embracing the sparkle, when festive and humdrum elements are tossed together, as they are in Gucci's no-holds-barred sandals. The result is a crazy salad that shocks and delights. If the unalloyed laid lies low, the jolie laid, that delicious mashup of beauty and imperfection, vibrates with vitality. In her memoir, 19th-century German actress Caroline Bauer captured the insuppressible appeal of the awkwardly attractive in describing her fascination with another performer, Duchesse de Berry, who, despite her ugliness, deemed herself irresistible. Along with her squinty eyes and frightfully skinny neck, de Berry possessed grace and stunningly dainty Cinderella feet. I have myself more than once stood in the Tuileries Gardens and gazed at this wondrous production of nature and art, Bauer recounted. Embracing the outre takes chutzpah, yet wearing a sparkly take on that which is not meant to sparkle is a pleasure akin to showing up at a high-end tea party in a rash guard or dipping a Frito in a silver dish of caviar. Try it, really. I like to amuse myself, said Elsa Schiaparelli, the legendary fashion designer, who in 1938 created suede ankle boots that sprouted long tufts of monkey fur. If I didn't, I would die. Today's impishly enticing shoes help to keep us from dying of boredom. They also generate desirable smoke signals. If dressing oneself in an aggressively unsexy manner conveys that one is in the know, then the woman who wears Gucci's ritzy hiking shoe, or Valentino's feather-festooned sandals, or the Attico design that couples a stately pump with crystal fringe, is doubly in the know. She's choosing funny over flat, self-expression over self-erasure. I look down at my new, deliciously fancy take on otherwise frumpy footwear and think, you can put lipstick on a pig, and you'd be a fool not to. Keziah Weir writes on style. Face value, for staying on time in style, a watch still beats a screen. Now a treasured timepiece goes petite. Photographed by Kiernan Monaghan and Theo van Vunakis. Vaillant Blanc de Cartier watch, in 18-carat rose gold, diamond, and leather. Priced at $8,400. Just over a decade ago, Cartier launched the Bayon Bleu, an instant bestseller intended to evoke a balloon floating on a wrist. Louis Cartier had a fascination with all things airborne and pioneered the men's wristwatch in 1904 after his friend, the renowned aviator Alberto Santos Dumont, complained about the impracticality of a pocket watch in flight. Now the Bleu's ladylike counterpart, the Bayon Blanc, has returned, marked by its delicate dial and a solitaire diamond nestled at the 4 o'clock curve. The stone's placement bears another aerial echo. In ballet, Bayon describes the phenomenon in which a dancer, mid-leap, seems to pause weightlessly aloft, making the name even more fitting for a watch whose face appears to stretch time. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.